Today we make our way to the final epistles of Paul that we have in the New Testament. We call these the pastoral epistles. And I can say for me as a pastor, I speak as a pastor, not as a professor now, these books have been the most instrumental to me in terms of how to lead God's church. And I owe a lot to Paul. Someday I'm going to need to thank him for writing these letters to Timothy. I can see how the Lord made things difficult in Paul's life, where he couldn't actually go and be with people as much as he wanted to. He would have preferred a face-to-face connection, like I think all of us know is much better. But God didn't allow him to do that in some cases. So we end up with these letters from Paul. And I'm glad that Paul wrote these things down, inspired of the Spirit. And so we make our way to Timothy, the two letters of to Timothy and to Titus, two of Paul's key traveling companions. I find it interesting as we get to the end of Paul's life, we don't have letters written to churches. We have letters written to individuals. We have a similar thing happening in Paul's life, perhaps, that happens in most of our lives. You know, as we get near the end of our lives, I mean, I think most of us really think in terms of our closest relationships, and you want to invest in people that are, you know, family, relatives, people that are key in your life. And we see this actually happening in Paul's life, and in these three letters that we'll look at today. I sum up 1 Timothy with this theme, church order in the body. I think that sums up what he's actually saying in the book. He's talking about order is our key word for 1 Timothy. And it's order in the church. It's order in the body of Christ. Interesting that Paul would be thinking about this as he's not quite to the end of his life in 1 Timothy. We're looking at a date of around AD 62. Now, Paul, of course, doesn't know how many years he has to live at this point, but he's just come close to death, as we see in the letter to the Philippians. He ended up getting out of prison, but he wasn't sure during those 2 years in Rome whether he was going to actually make it until the Lord revealed to him, no, this is not the end here. I have more for you to do. So after 2 years in Rome, he gets freed in AD 62, and he's able to travel again. And it was during this time that he wrote the letter to Timothy, the first letter here. He's very clear about his purpose. It's right in the middle of the letter. He says in 1 Timothy 3, 14 to 15, although I hope to come to you soon, I'm writing you these instructions so that if I'm delayed, you will know how people ought to conduct themselves in God's household, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and foundation of truth. So there you have it. As close to a purpose statement as you'll find in this letter. Here's why I'm writing you, Timothy. I'm writing you so that people will know how to conduct themselves in God's household. He's talking about the church as if the church is a building, you know, and each of us is a different part of that building. What part do you play? If you can use the building analogy. Are you a chair? Are you a window? Are you a door? Are you a ceiling? Are you a fan? You know, each one of the parts of this building that we're in right now plays a unique part. And when it all works together, when everything does what it's supposed to do, there's a sense of order. All of you you all look pretty orderly today. Everybody's facing the right direction. Your seats are not falling apart, right? I hope not. Although sometimes I think these tables need a little bit of the screwdriver just to tighten them up a little bit. But that's like the church as well. We all need these little tweakings And you find this in the letter as well as some large issues in the letter. I sum it up, but Paul exhorts Timothy to courageously guard his personal life. That's certainly very important for one leading a church. Doctrine. So he's better watch his theology. And local church order. So in other words, it goes from Timothy to the body as well, in order to preserve the ministry of the Ephesian church against ascetic and speculative false teachers. So there's two types of false teachers. The ascetic ones were ones that were big on pain, you know. Some people love pain, you know. You know, harsh treatment of the body, just to be encouraged about how disciplined they are and all that, you know. These were the people who, maybe our modern day ones would be people that just kill themselves with these exercise programs, you know, and these diets. I hope you're not one of those people that's just changing diets all the time, right? Because you've got kind of the latest thing. That's what these people were like. And so they felt that harsh treatment of the body was going to lead to, you know, purity of spirit. And then other speculative false teachers as well. The fact that they were speculating about all kinds of things is a factor that takes, that encourages some scholars to say, oh, these letters must be really, really late. Because they must be second century. Because you couldn't have speculative teaching in the first century, could you? And when I hear these sort of arguments, I think, well, what universe are you living in? It doesn't take very long for false teaching to come in. And we're focusing in on the 60s, actually for a few weeks of the course here, because so much literature in the New Testament was written in the 60s. And we see a huge emphasis among these various books in respect to false teaching. We saw it in the prison epistles. The Colossian heresy, the problem between Jews and Gentiles at Ephesus, that we see in Ephesians. We'll see it. Peter noted it in 2 Peter. All these are written, you know, AD 61 to 63, 64. And so it doesn't take very long for false teaching to come on in. So, in terms of the kingdom, one of our key phrases that we think of in terms of the kingdom, in terms of blessing, like a benediction you find here in 1 Timothy, where he says, now to the King eternal, immortal, invisible, the only God, be honor and glory forever and ever. Amen. He says that right at the beginning, chapter 1, verse 17. And he refers to Jesus in chapter 6. Verse 14, as the King of Kings, he urges him to keep this command without spot or blame until the appearing of our Lord Jesus Christ, which God will bring about in his own time. God, the blessed and only ruler, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Wow. So, how about covenant? New covenant we just read about as God's household, the new covenant community, which God calls, or Paul calls here, the pillar and foundation of truth. You ever thought of you and your church as being the pillar and foundation of truth? I mean, where's your society actually going to get truth? Except from the church. Yes, you have a constitution in your country and you have laws, but what's actually the foundation of those laws? We all know that around the world, governments are enacting crazy laws right now. Are you familiar with these? Some of these laws? Governments don't invent laws just out of anywhere. They have some kind of foundation. If they don't have a foundation in truth, which comes from God himself, they've got some other foundation And I find that in my own country, it seems like the foundation that people are following now more than anything else is this foundation of tolerance. Mm-hmm. So whatever is tolerant is deemed to be the most compassionate, the most secure, providing the most rights for the most people. And so we need to be very, very tolerant of people. That ends up becoming a new God. I read about a story of a high school girl who is has gender dysphoria, and I don't know if you counselors are talking about this much. I suspect you are, right? You are getting some training in this area, right? So she wanted to compete on the boys' team. So that meant, I mean, she believes she's a boy, but the boys didn't want her to be in the boys' locker room, but she was not identifying as a girl. So where are you going to put this young woman? The school decided to build a separate locker room for her. So they added on to the building, and they put her own shower there, changing room, locker, all this, just for her, to try to accommodate her, because she's, you know, they felt like they would be violating the rights of the 99% of the others who were either in the men's room or the women's locker room. Well, she took the school to court because she said she's a boy. And she's charging the school with discrimination against her because she's identifying as a boy, and for her not to be in the boys' locker room and changing with the boys, she deems as a discrimination. I don't know where this case is going to go, who's actually going to win it, but it illustrates the craziness of a society when they don't know the living God, the pillar and foundation of truth. And it's the church that sets that in order in society. And you go around the world and you will see where the society has flourished. I don't know if there's an a difference, if there's an exception, I mean. But in societies where you have religious freedom and a financial prosperity, you're typically going to find a church at the basis of this. The gospel has gone there. The gospel goes throughout the world, and the gospel sets a foundation of truth. And when people live according to truth, they know how to treat one another, and there's a sense of prosperity that follows. I remember some years ago, I'll tell you another story. You got time for a few stories. I was in Borneo, okay? I was teaching some pastors there, and went out to the villages out from the city to see, to teach some rural pastors. I remember visiting one village, and this little village was the most prosperous village in the whole area, but it was also the Christian village. And it wasn't that way 20 years before. All the villages were poor. And one of the reasons they were all poor is because they just didn't show any concern for one another. People would have their pigs, but they wouldn't tie up their pigs, because it was to their advantage for their pigs to roam in the village and eat up all their neighbor's vegetables. Right? If your pig eats up your neighbor's vegetable, your pig ends up fatter and bigger, and you have a nicer feast. Right? And, of course, the relationships among the villagers was not very good, because everybody was doing all of this. They also were... they also had an interesting way to get fish. They discovered that if they'd go upstream and they would dump cyanide in the river, then all they had to do was go out right in front of their river, and then all these fish would just be floating along, and they would just pick the fish off the top of the river and then eat them. Ingenious way to kill yourself, isn't it? Well, some missionaries came into this community and they shared the gospel with this village, and this village as a whole embraced the gospel. They all trusted Christ. And what came out of that was they started showing concern for their neighbors. And so they started penning up, they put fences around their houses. And so there, and then they put fences around their pigs. And they started growing crops in front of their homes, you know, within their fenced enclosures. And everybody started doing that. And they started feeding their own pigs. That helped their relationships with their neighbors. They started growing crops. And they started being able to eat their own food and share and bless one another. And the relationships in the village improved remarkably. And because everybody wasn't out to get after everybody else, and they no longer threw cyanide in the river, and they went out and caught fish in a legitimate way, their children were not sick anymore. They weren't, you know, taking all the cyanide in their bodies. And to me, it was an amazing story of how the gospel transforms. They end up becoming the richest village around, and they become, and they're becoming the envy of all their other villages, saying, why have they prospered so much in recent years? And it gave them a platform to be able to share the gospel out to other places. Isn't it true for us when we live the life that God gives us a sense of peace and security, and this church that God has made, the church of the living God, is indeed the pillar and the foundation of truth. And then truth leads to order, and order leads to blessing. This is the process I see happening in our churches. When the church is disorderly, it's generally because there's divisions in the church and people are out, you know, selfish. They're out for themselves, and you end up with all kinds of problems. Now, Paul had experienced this in some of his churches, and so he wrote Timothy and he said, I want you to see how important it is for the church there at Ephesus to be the foundation of order in society, but your church has got to be that way, first of all. The church has to be orderly. We also see a redemption in the letter, where Paul refers to his own testimony. Here's a trustworthy saying, chapter 1, verse 15. Trustworthy saying that deserves full acceptance. Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am the worst. Now, if you look at that objectively, was Paul really the worst sinner of them all? I think he's exaggerating a bit here. But I find it encouraging to me. Paul's, at this time, has been a Christian for about 30 years, but he still hasn't forgotten about where he came from. And many of us have been Christians for, I've been a Christian for 45 plus years now. It's a good thing to remember what life is like before you were trusted Christ. And Paul seemed to not forget that. And he remembered how bad he was, to the point of imprisoning Christians and perhaps even killing some Christians. Acts doesn't specifically say he killed them, but he did imprison them, and some of them were delivered over to death. And Paul has this great remembrance of that. This is a challenge for me when I get in taxis and I try to tell a taxi driver what it's like to go from being a non-Christian to be a Christian after so many years. I pray for myself and I pray for you that it'll still be fresh in your mind like it was for Paul when he wrote this letter. Yeah. I mean, you guys have been so quiet so far. I've been going on for 19 minutes, and I don't think you've said a word yet, but you're sure welcome to join on in any of these. If you have any question or any comments about this. Jesus is also called Lord of Lords at the end. So we see this, the deity or the lordship of Christ mentioned several times in the letter. Assuming chapter 6, verse 15 is talking about Jesus. well, he's called Lord Jesus Christ, so, but then it says, which God will bring about in his own time, God the blessed and only ruler of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. I don't know if Paul is making a great distinction here between the Father and the Son, but in any case. So what we've got here is church order. How do you actually have church order? Church order is maintained by giving priority to five different things that are noted in the letter. Obviously, there's more than this as well, but this was enough for Timothy to put in practice, these six chapters. So if you give priority to these five things, Paul says that the church, the pillar and foundation of society, is going to function in an orderly manner so that they can have, the church can have an impact in their community. So here they are. Chapter 1, give priority to combating false teachers. Make sure you don't let heresy proliferate within your congregation. Be concerned about what is taught. Don't just get warm bodies filling the teaching positions in your church. I really owe my wife a lot on this one, because I know she needs help teaching the children. But she has such a passion to do this, and she says, you know, there's a lot of women in the church that just, and others, men, that they're just not ready to teach the kids yet, because it's difficult teaching children, even more difficult than teaching the adults. My heart goes out to her. How many of you teach children on a regular basis? You're teaching children. Really? Not that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay. All right. About a quarter of you all. That's good. I mean, that's really building for the future. Give priority to church life, in particular worship. This is chapters 2 and 3. Does it matter what kind of worship you have here? Yeah. And you notice Paul doesn't mention anything in these chapters about the kinds of things that we have our worship wars about. He doesn't say, well, if you're going to really have good order in terms of worship, you need to start with a fairly upbeat song, and then it's going to move on into prayer, and then it's got to, then you need to shift key. You go from the minor key right on over to the major key here, and so many of these things end up becoming such a huge concern to us in worship, rather than talking about the kinds of things that Paul talks about. So we'll take a look at chapters 2 and 3. Give priority to your personal life and doctrine, chapter 4. In other words, set an example for the people. And here's a warning about watching his own life. And need I tell you more stories about pastors that have fallen? I don't think I need to tell you any more stories, right? I think you've all heard so many stories already. And Paul knew that that was definitely a potential in Timothy's life. As far as we know, Timothy was faithful to the Lord to the end, but he needed that warning. We all needed that warning. We all need that warning. Then he talks about a ministry to various church groups. He'll do the same thing in Titus as well. How do you deal with widows and elders and slaves, etc., and then more on false teachers? And finally, it's more of a personal word to Timothy, but I guess to all those in the church, in terms of a warning against materialism. He tells Timothy, make sure that, well, you're not a lover of money. He actually mentions that in chapter 3. But make sure you don't get tripped up on money, but tell those who are rich in this world to also be rich in good deeds, he says. So it's all ordered around this concept of order. All right? No pun intended. All right. I'm going to take a sip of my coffee, and then you ask a question, all right? Or you have a comment. Certainly you're thinking of something. What's on your heart?
Just to clarify, so when you say worship here, it doesn't mean lifestyle worship. It really means like the congregation worshiping, right?
I think chapters 2 and 3 are in the context of congregational worship, yeah. Because he starts off chapter 2 and he says, first of all, I want to make sure that prayers and petitions be made known for all people. Mm-hmm. And then he talks about women and how they dress. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's talking about how they dress at home. Mm-hmm. Verse 9, women dress modestly with decency and propriety. And then he talks about a woman's role in the church, verses 11 to 15, or 11 to 14, and then the priority of childbearing for women in verse 15. So he's talking about what, in the local church context, that he's saying that the priority in the worship is for men to be the teachers. In verse 11, in verse 12. So I don't think he's talking about life in general. I think every one of us knows that women are the biggest and best teachers in our lives. Has it not been that way in your life? Some years ago, our 16th president of the United States was, Abraham Lincoln was invited to a ceremony, and they went and they looked up all of his teachers in his life. They got his every, and they gathered them all together at the White House, and they had this big celebration for President Lincoln. And it was a really wonderful evening for him. And they asked him to close, so he got up at the end, and they asked him to say any final words if you want to say thanks. And he said, "I really appreciate you bringing these teachers in my, all these key teachers in my life." He said, "But you missed one." And the organizers were like, "Oh no, who did we miss? Who did we miss? I thought we went all the way through, we got everyone." He said, "I don't see my mother here. It appears you didn't invite my mother." And what they had missed was they had missed the most important teacher in Abraham Lincoln's life, in your life, and in my life. And I try to remember that story when I'm with my mom. Especially my mother's, you know, next year she's going to be 90, God willing. And she's not as sharp as she used to be, you know. Who is? But it's great for me to remember my mom. Even now, I'm amazed. My mother was a single mother with four children, ages 6 to 1. Can you believe that? I'm number 2. My mother had 4 children in 5 years. And then with the breakup of their marriage, I'm amazed to see my mother went and did what you're doing. She went and got a master's degree with these 4 young kids, a master's degree in social work. She ended up being a social worker, counselor, child protective services, adoption. She helped a lot of families in the San Francisco area. Now I look at it and I think what I know now, knowing how difficult getting a master's degree is, how did my mother get a master's degree with 4 of these screaming kids running around home as a single mother at UC Berkeley, one of the most difficult schools there are, you know? And it's amazing. So I say that so that you will hopefully see the value of your mother in your life. Was your mother perfect? Obviously not, right? But I think the point here in bringing up what women will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith, love, holiness, and propriety. That's a difficult verse. As a lot of us think, you know, we think too shallowly when we see words like saved, that the woman's going to be saved. Oh no, what about us single ladies, you know? Are we saved? You know, do you have to have children to be saved, you know? It's obviously talking about delivered, or it's obviously about that the concept is one of blessing, that women as a whole are going to be, most of them are going to be raising children. And we have a lot of problems in our societies because men have not affirmed their wives so that their wives feel affirmed in their role at home. And I don't blame the women on this. I think the men hold a lot of the blame here. in not helping their wives see what an honorable thing this is to raise children. Those are the mothers who work full time, I'll tell you. Those are the women who work full time. The women who work full time are mothers, you know. The rest of us get a break. But anyway, I could go on and on about this, but chapter 3, in our answer to Charmaine's question, is these are local church positions of elders, deacons, so it's still talking about the church as a whole, and it ends with what we have in terms of our theme verse there. About the church being the pillar and foundation of truth.
I think I have another question.
Sure, no one else is answering questions. Ask two.
Yeah, it's regarding church leadership about submitting to leaders.
Okay.
Okay, so that's two questions. Number one is, are there anything called personal arena of decision making? Because naturally, some people will feel that in terms of marriage, our leaders shouldn't have a voice over who they choose. So as leaders, do we even, I feel that we should give advice, as well as the marriage prep and all things.
Right? Oh, okay.
Yeah, but
okay, so your question is, to what degree do the...
What degree is our... I think most leaders would not dare say a black and white, but we would still give advice, right? But these matters can be so personal, and I wonder, I mean, if it's a divorce case, we would come in and speak about it as well.
Okay, so do you mean that if two young people want to get married,
and you feel that
and you think that they're not ready, that they're overstepping their bounds, that the leader shouldn't...
We should speak about it, right? It shouldn't be a personal matter between them.
Well, any two relationships in the church affect the church as a whole, right?
Yes.
And especially the marriage relationship. Your church is as strong as the marriages within your church. So if you're a church leader, one of the best things you can do to strengthen your church is to strengthen the marriages in your church. And in particular, strengthen the men. I know, ladies, you don't have that opportunity a lot, but I think for us men here, we need to be investing ourselves in the men. And I see in my own church, I counted up the last 10 people who became members last year. My heart delighted last month when I did it, and I realized, oh, 6 of them were men. Not only have anything against women, I think women are pretty cool as well, but we need men to come forth and take leadership. If I have the man committed to Jesus, the family follows. But I've seen over and over, having a committed mother doesn't mean that you're going to have the family there. So I think a pastor's concern for a young couple getting married, that they marry the right person, is really a legitimate thing. Often people are coming to us even from other churches. Susan and I, we get taken out for meals. Well, sometimes we haven't come to our apartments. We pay for the meal, but we get some free meals doing this, you know. People say, what do you think? And we just ask some questions, you know. And some of the couples we feel really maybe not so comfortable about, but others we do. I think it's a wonderful thing to ask someone, especially someone that's, you know, that you're going to know. Am I answering what you're asking?
Yeah, actually.
Yeah. But I think we are too individualistic, and we don't consider the corporate dimension nowadays. The more urban, the more individualistic. The more rural, the more community-oriented we are. And this place, have you noticed this is pretty urban? And Singapore has a difficult time, like any other city, bringing community. This is one of the reasons why there's so many people who need counseling. Do you remember the question that was asked in counseling week? The first night? Why is it that so many people are experiencing depression? Do you remember that? I thought the answer was brilliant. The reason so many people experience depression is because there's so many fragmented relationships in our urban environment. The city tends to break up families, and so it's quite a challenge to be in ministry in the city. One of our speakers years ago, who came to the 40th anniversary at SBC in 1992, Os Guinness, who's a great thinker. He said something I'm still thinking about. What is it, 27 years later? He said, modernism has made evangelism easy and discipleship hard. By modernism, he was also meaning urbanization. When you have this urban environment, kind of cities and modernization kind of go together, don't they? We have so many opportunities to evangelize. I mean, there's so many people around. We have all the technology. Look at Singapore, over 400 English-speaking churches. It's not hard to hear the gospel in this place. There's a church near you, wherever you are. You know what I mean? And so many people are sharing the gospel. But to really become true disciples of Christ, it is far more difficult in the city. Just give you an example. Just moving around. Just getting small groups together. It's tough. It's difficult with so many people moving from one place to the other, from 5 o'clock to 8 o'clock every night. You know, all this traffic in front of Singapore Bible College, some of you might think, oh, it's always been that way. No, it hasn't been that way. We didn't have traffic like this back when I started here in the 90s. But with the population being double now than it was back then, it does make it very difficult just to get people together. Some churches are even starting to have Skype prayer groups. Have you ever heard of a Skype prayer group? Everybody stays in their home. Friday night comes, everybody logs onto the same Skype group on Friday night, and they all look at their computers, and, you know, maybe 10 of them or something like that, and you can do group chat, group Skype. You can do it on Zoom or whatever, you know, whatever kind of software you have. And then they all pray together. You know, pray to their... it's not praying to a computer screen. It's not like the computer's the idol or anything like that. But they're praying with one another. They're trying to deal with the reality of how do you make discipleship happen in an urban environment. One of my students from Sri Lanka is doing his dissertation, which I was just reading last night, and he talks about how it's difficult to get along. I mean, get around and get along when you can't get around, right? And so all the focus of the church is all ministry on Sunday because people are living far away and it's hard to get around. And that's not good. You have to overcome that. We need to disperse people to having community groups closer where they are. And if you can't do that, praying on Skype with your group is certainly better than not praying at all, isn't it? So, yeah. Good thoughts. Any other questions before Charmaine has her third question? Yes.
I have a question.
Then hold that one, okay?
Okay. So, I think it could be addressed, you may be addressing this in Titus, but so I was just reading about, you know, elders and you know, a really nice slide around, like, the responsibility of elders around administration, pastoral, and teaching.
Okay, so elder responsibilities.
Yeah, my church just had an AGM this last Saturday. And in the AGM, we voted for matters around some big decisions, I'll say. So I was just wondering, I mean, what would the Apostle Paul be thinking about AGMs in, you know, in the context of today, right? Or if, you know, big churches and, you know, where decisions are made by the congregation around to a matter of voting, right? Whereas,
okay.
Yeah, whereas as I read, you know, the role of elders, really, as congregation, it seems like our responsibility is just to vote in the elders and to decide these are the elders. And the elders really should have the, because we trust these elders, they make the decisions, right, around big and
okay.
small decisions.
So you are in a congregational church, mm-hmm. and you're wondering, should the church be more elder focused?
Yes, and also, but I also understand the constitution of a society or a church body in the
yeah.
context of Singapore, and therefore AGMs and where big decisions are made do get voted. I can't tell if part of it is kind of legislature versus how we do church these days.
Well, there are different types of organizations in Singapore law. One is a society. And another is a limited company. So if you're going to start a church in Singapore, you have to decide which way you're going to go. The simpler way is to be a limited company. And so when I helped start our church, we made it a limited company. So we do need to have an annual meeting, an AGM, annual general meeting. And it's a good thing to do that by law. The people ought to know where the money's going. So I just led our annual meeting 2 weeks ago, so it's fresh on my mind. So we present the audited accounts. Gave people opportunity to ask questions. And we voted on, I don't know, those of you who go to other churches, let me know if it's the same, but we vote on four things. Approve the elders' report, so I wrote a 2-page report. Approve the audit. Say yeah. I don't know what happens if you don't approve the audit. Maybe somebody knows that some money's being stole somewhere and the auditors didn't catch it or something like that. But the third one thing is to approve the auditors for the next year. So we just have the same company. And the last one is any other matters, and that would sometimes the any other matters would refer to bringing on new elders or deacons or something like that. It does seem to me that the people ought to have a say in whether they are approving of their leadership or not. Their elders, their deacons, and in our church, I'm an elder, but I'm more like a full-time, not really a full-time elder because I'm more full-time here at SBC. But I think the people ought to have a say as to whether they want me to be the pastor or not. So I've written it up in our bylaws. This is how you get rid of me if you want to get rid of me. You know, there's this process, you know. because I need to serve at the people's, for their benefit. If I serve for my own benefit, it's no good.
Yeah, and
so does that answer the question?
It does, to a certain extent. I do agree and absolutely that we should vote in and decide on the elders and who gets selected, because that's the leadership of the church. Mm-hmm. But around decisions, for instance, we were planning to invest, you know, in...
What do you do with money?
So I think the presentation of the financial statements and all that, and to answer your question, mm-hmm. as an accountant, I'll say that if you don't get it approved, you can't file the financial statements. You know, so you break laws, right? But it's the decision, it was around, like, should we invest in this new, this investment and all that. I was just wondering whether, is this something that we appoint the elders and the elders should decide? Or is this something we bring back to the congregation and as a congregation we decide on this?
I think different churches will do it different ways, mm-hmm. and you should be in a church where you agree with that. Mm-hmm. I know the culture in my own church. Mm-hmm. The culture is, would you please make decisions? We have so many decisions to make. You guys just make as many as possible. Send the missionary to the send the money to the missionaries you think are the best, and pay whatever. I've tried to get more people involved in the decision-making process, and they just keep saying, well, we trust you. I mean, I could steal all kinds of money, I think, and no one would ever know it, but God would know it. But I'm not smart enough to know how to do that. But, you know, you should go with that culture. I personally like the way we do it. If you want to change the order of service, I don't want to put it up for congregational vote.
Yeah.
If we want to change the color or the logo, I did change the logo a few years ago of the church. I had my son, who's a graphic designer, design a new logo, and then we put it all up. We put it all made all the cards and all that. And then one of the men in the church said, well, that kind of looks like a brain on the logo. It looks like somebody's splitting the brain right in half. I thought, oh, boy. We really should have asked his opinion, a few other people's opinion on it. He was trying to depict, you know, the HDB, you know, in a more poetic or, you know, whatever form. And anyway, so it's really great to get input from other people. I tend to do it more on an informal basis rather than putting a lot of things up for vote. I think we only take a vote maybe once a year at our church, and there's a lot of trust in our leadership. If you need to vote on everything, you need to ask why you need to vote on everything. If you feel you need to vote on everything, I think the underlying cause might be you just really don't trust your leaders. Yeah. You know.
But does Apostle Paul say anything about this? It seemed like he was suggesting that we should just trust the leaders that we elect.
Well, I have helped four, maybe five churches shift from a congregational form of leadership to an elder form. And why? Because I have these Baptist heritage, but I see some of the limitations and the positive parts of the congregational Baptist way to do it. But I think it can cause a lot of disunity, and people end up so concerned about things that really don't matter. I mean, literally churches have split over the color of the carpet, those sort of things. They really haven't split over the color of the carpet. The color of the carpet was the last straw in all kinds of things that had preceded that. And I think the focus of 1 Timothy is on having godly leaders. That's the focus. But of course, he says the church is the pillar and foundation of truth. We need a godly church as well. But I think godly leaders will lead to godly church. Lloyd, did you have a thought?
Just want to
add to what she's going to say.
And I can understand where she's coming from. We see it as a church decision. And in most cases, I'll talk about AGM now.
Yeah.
Church as a group, to me, are not the best decision makers. Some are very technical, and the people behind should be a chosen group of people who are expertise in this area. Let's say you talk about building a new premise. We are all very dependent on some scripture verses presented to us, some thoughts. But is this the best decision, and should it be put to the church to a vote, and thereafter it is the church decision?
Okay, this
against,
is... Yeah. This is a problem with the democracy. The people who make the decisions are the least informed.
Yes.
But you ask their opinion. But I'm pro democracy. I'm not for dictatorship.
The decision is already 90% decided before it's presented to the church to decide.
Yeah. Read it. What was your thought?
Going back to Edwin's question, when Paul wrote those, seven elected ones and everything, I think the criteria then was quite different when they selected the elders as it is now.
Oh, really? Okay.
I feel. Because
you think the criteria was...
Yeah, I think the criteria...
You mean
changed.
It should be different?
No, it has or? Changed over time, depending on the culture, the demographics of the church. So it has sometimes we find that in churches, the positions are also set according to their secular jobs attached to it to see what they could bring into the church. It's not a wrong thing. However, sometimes when the power lies in these seven people or so in the elected committee, they run a church like an organization that is run outside.
Yeah.
So that I find I have an issue with, because not everything is, permissible. Not everything is what?
You're saying that the church should not be run like a business.
I feel that,
okay.
Yes. So sometimes I think it's important. We need to weigh as to the cost of the decision making, as in what, how does it, and also it depends on the capacity of the congregation, the numbers. If it's a very huge congregation, then it is also going to be difficult to make decisions on a general consensus.
Okay, so
yeah.
Church size would impact it.
Yeah.
Here's another thing. How old and how mature are the people in the church?
Mm-hmm.
In general, I think leadership should be more directive, hierarchical in small, younger churches with new believers. You don't want to put major issues, doctrinal issues, in the hands of new Christians who don't, you know, who don't know.
So. I just want to quote some examples, because at one time I remember that the church was going through a deficit and they were trying to cut costs. So the people who were, the committee were people who were managing big organizations outside, and the first thing they could think of was chop, chop, chop. And it really broke the fiber of the heart of the people.
Yeah.
And many people were laid off, the church workers. And I don't think that was the right way, but they just felt that was the best way about doing or managing the church. So again, as I said, it depends on the people who are elected. Also.
And here's the goal. What's the goal? There's the question. What's the goal? Is the goal of the local church to make a profit?
Mm-hmm.
If that's the goal, then you're gonna have a whole lot of different. I was in a church once where they weren't making budgets, so they took the cell phones away from the pastors. It's like, all right, we're going to save money here. You know, if you want a cell phone, get your own cell phone. And the pastor's like, well, this is our whole connection to the congregation, for people to call us. This is how we meet with people. We meet at Starbucks, you know, whatever. They kept their cell phones. They just have paid from their own, on their own money, and but had this quiet nagging, you know, about it. Peter, did you have a thought? Or you, go ahead. We're going to go a couple minutes over, and then I'll still give you your 10-minute break.
One of the things is that my understanding of Timothy is that apart from the ability to teach, it's all about character rather than expertise.
Very good. It is.
So, but obviously you do need people in churches that, you know, have some expertise in areas. But I think the balance should be on godly people who then are then advised perhaps by people who are qualified in certain areas. I mean, on a leadership team, it would be great to have godly leaders who are also skilled in different areas.
And you speak as a man with a lot of pastoral experience, and I take that because you've seen what it's like otherwise. Here's what it's like otherwise. Chuck Swindoll says it well in his book, Excellence in Ministry. How do we pick leaders? We often pick leaders based on popularity, past, you know, we've always had that person as a leader, politics, oh, he's, you know, kind of made his way into the whole thing, pocketbook, you can't have a poor elder, right? You can't have even a middle-class elder in some churches, you know, and profession. Those are the P's. That's how we often do it. Now, which of those are biblical? None of them. So how about general reputation, being above reproach, having a good reputation with outsiders, being respectable? That's true of both overseers and deacons. This is at the O and the D. I'm on the... How about family life? When's the last time, Adeline, you're an accountant? Did your family life get evaluated to become an accountant? I would dare say no, right? They don't care. They want to know. Do you know how to do accountancy? You know, not so with the church. Family life is paramount. Who's going to know that person the best? Where is his life going to show up the most? What kind of person he is? It's going to be in his family. Husband of one wife. Wife worthy of respect. A lot of things, actually, for the deacons here. There's a lot of qualities of the wife, interestingly. Seeing that his children obey. avoiding these negative characteristics. Not quick-tempered or violent or quarrelsome or new convert, pursuing dishonest gain, addicted to wine. I think all of these still apply. And what about positive characteristics? Hospitable, sensible, tested, sincere. And then the one that's a key one for elders that you don't find for deacons is able to teach. That doesn't say able to preach. It doesn't say stimulating preacher. That's not what it says. It says able has an ability to communicate to other people what the Bible says. And I think somebody ought to be teaching at some levels in the church, and you'd be able to evaluate their teaching before you start asking the person to become an elder. There's a man at my church right now, I hadn't really considered as an elder, but he's really been doing great in the area of teaching, and his group is growing, and people are getting blessed, and I'd be happy to consider him as an elder now. So much more to say about all this, because we're talking about a huge, huge issue, and perhaps we can address some of it in Titus as well. But yes. And then one last one, then we'll take a break. Yeah.
So are all these like commands? I don't know, because like previously in the lecture you talked about certain things that in the Bible as cultural, or
yeah.
Are they like commands?
Are they commands?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I view them as commands. Yeah, I see these at Ephesus. They're going to be. There's a lot of parallels to Titus 1, where he's talking to Titus. We'll see in the next class session. That's a different place in Crete. There's parallels there to Acts 6, of being full of wisdom and full of the Spirit. And you know, these are the kinds of things that you want for leaders. We're not talking about apostles here. We're not talking about prophets, but we are talking about local church leaders. And so what I do is I take the list in Titus and the list in 1 Timothy, combine them together, and you get 20 qualities for an elder. In my understanding, I have this on page 223, they relate only to men. Only men can be husbands of one wife, right? If the woman can be a husband or wife, one wife, go for it, you know? Well, maybe not. Maybe not. I shouldn't say that in our day. All qualifications are essential. So, yeah, I've had some men that, really wonderful guys, but they really need work on one particular area, like anger or using his money wisely, you know, or whatever. I can think of different men. I want them to work on that area, so that would not be a stumbling block. They can refer to the present life of the leader. We've all failed in the past, but have we learned from it? And we're talking about overseers or deacons here. I think these qualifications also must be maintained. So if a leader fails in these, he needs to step down. In his family life, for example, it's good to step down, give attention to your family. And I think family life, he's talking about children here. He's not talking about older people whose children are really responsible for their own decisions. The qualifications emphasize character over abilities. I see only two abilities. I agree with what Pastor Peter said here. The only two abilities are able to teach and able to manage his household well. There should be a teaching and a management ability. Everything else, the other 18, are all character related. And then they emphasize managing home over work. Family life is far more important than work life in this. So let's hold any other questions, and maybe we can talk about them when we talk about Titus. It is also talking about local church in some important areas. But at this point, I'll leave it at this. I'll take a break. All right. Thank you all for your input.